frequency like no other. 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish current affairs and culture show. And if you were reading the Jewish Report a couple of weeks ago, you would have seen an article on Mr. Harry Schwartz, a name which might be familiar to a lot of us in the community, for his work in politics and humanitarian relief, as well as his commitment to the Jewish community. And it was such an interesting article that I thought we would get onto the line one of his grandchildren, who now lives in the UK, Adam Schwartz, and just talk a little bit about his life of what was a remarkable man. Adam, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us on the New Blue Review.
Not at all. Thank you very much for the invite. I'm a huge fan of the show. I regularly tune in from London. So you know others who also tune in from abroad. So you certainly have quite a wide sort of group of listeners. So thank you very much for inviting me. It's great to be on.
It's good to know we have an international listenership. Adam, for a start, maybe give us a sense about your grandfather. A lot of people have said that his commitment to justice and supporting the underdog came from his time in Germany. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, it's a brilliant... I'm telling the story of people's lives. Obviously, the beginning seems like an obvious place to start, but I think it's particularly true with him because his sort of experience in Germany... sort of had such a defining moment on sort of defining impact on who he was and really what he stood for. So he's born in 1924 in Cologne in the Weimar Republic in Germany, and so obviously it was a very difficult time to be growing up as a sort of Jewish family. He was born into a sort of not particularly religious family, but sort of traditional Ashkenazi family. And he had sort of strong memories of, basically experiencing the rise of Nazism under Hitler and, what really that brought about. Particularly he had, strong memories of leaving school because he was Jewish. He also had strong memories of having to basically be kicked off public transport because he was Jewish. Those kind of memories of discrimination from simply who he was really had such an important impact on who he was. But it also, his sort of experience coming to South Africa also had a very important impact on sort of what he stood for. So he came to South Africa in 1934 with his family. His father had come the year before. He had to leave Germany the night Hitler came to power because he was a Social Democratic Party activist, and so had to leave faster than the rest of the family. But he sort of also had memories of being taunted at school, even in South Africa, for being different. He didn't speak any English or Afrikaans at first, so he was really treated as an outsider. So that really had such a important part on sort of who he was in later life. I think also he had sort of Afrikaner nationalism. In 1937, the South African government tried to sort of appease nationalist elements within the country by basically introducing legislation to halt all Jewish immigration from Europe. And there was one final vote that was called the Stuttgart that left Europe in 1936 that carried German refugees to South Africa. And that carried his grandparents. And say it was the last ship to be allowed into South Africa before the legislation came into force. So while he was waiting in Cape Town for his family, there was also a huge anti-Jewish demonstration led by Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who you'll know well, was later the architect of apartheid. He was basically saying, "Jews go home." And he never really forgot that sort of welcome that he gave to his family. So it's very early experiences of both discrimination from himself, but also sort of from sort of right-wing Afrikaner nationalism that really led him to be the person he was in later life.
It's very interesting, actually. I have family that was also on the Stuttgart, and for a lot of German refugees, it was certainly an important part of their journey to South Africa and a marked point at which things really began to change for the Jews here in the 30s. So that is interesting, and you can see how it would have affected his ideas about getting involved with the political struggle here. One of the ones I want to focus on is something called the Torch Commando, which he was an important part of creating. He was part of the war effort in World War II, and when he came back, he joined this thing called the Torch Commando. Can you talk to us about what that was and why it was so important?
Sure. Yeah, again, it's a brilliant question. So, as you know, the Torch Commando sort of grew out of a movement called the Springbok Legion. Basically, it was a group of wartime servicemen who decided, after the war was over and after the National Party came to power, that actually, you know, it was important, as people who had fought for their country and fought against nationalism in Europe, to actually fight it in South Africa when it grew as well. I think to my grandfather and a lot of other servicemen who fought in the Second World War, it was a real profound shock 3 years later, after the war ended in 1948, for the people who'd really been supporting Nazi Germany during the war to actually come to power in South Africa. World War II was obviously about, you know, ending far-right nationalism and fascism, and in his mind and others' mind, you know, it was a real shock to have those people sort of come to power. So him and a few others, including Sailor Malan, who was sort of a wartime hero for being sort of exceptional fighter pilots, decided that it was important to resist. So they formed this organization called the Torch Commando, which was essentially a group of starters, as you say, an ex-servicemen, who decided to sort of have peaceful protests where they would carry these torches around and sort of embarked upon civil action to protest initially the removal of coloured voters from the voters' call. But it actually became a very, very prominent organisation. At its height, it had 250,000 members, which, considering the population of white South Africans in 1951 when it began, was actually a very, very significant movement. So that's really when his kind of political involvement began. I think that's sort of when he began to sort of be involved in this kind of mass resistance to apartheid.
And he then decided to jump in with both feet, didn't he? Because having done the Torch Commando, he then got involved with one of the most high-profile cases, legal cases in South Africa history, because he was involved with the treason trial.
So he wasn't involved in the treason trial, he was actually involved in the Rivonia trial.
Excuse me, the Rivonia trial. Yes, I apologise.
Sure. So yeah, obviously, fascinating case to be involved in. So the way that he got involved, Harold Wolpe, one of the accused, was arrested, but he escaped from prison. And Harold Wolpe was married to the sister of someone called Jimmy Cantor. Jimmy Cantor was a lawyer in South Africa. He sort of disagreed with apartheid in principle, but he wasn't politically active. But he was friends with my grandfather. When Harold Wolpe escaped from prison, his very badly treated, and Jimmy then came to my grandfather and said, you know, what should we do? My sister's being very badly treated. My grandfather said he would raise it with the Minister of Police, but that, you know, it wouldn't be wise to go to the press, because actually that would sort of antagonise the police, who were already quite humiliated from the whole process of people escaping from the trial. So Jimmy actually decided to go to the press and raise the fact that his sister was being badly beaten in prison or when she was detained. Unfortunately, then Jimmy was then arrested, and then my grandfather acted as his defence. Jimmy was later found to be one of only two in the trial to be acquitted, but unfortunately, because of the bad treatment that he received as well, he was sort of very badly affected by it, both sort of psychologically, professionally. His sort of professional reputation was ruined, having been associated with the trial, even though he really had nothing to do with any of the activities of the other people accused.
Well, of course, what was so interesting about that trial was it included all of these different
people like Nelson Mandela and Walter Sisulu and a range of other anti-apartheid activists, Dennis Goldberg, Arthur Goldreich, and you can actually go and see it at a great museum today. And it was all of those greats of the ANC back then. So it was such an important trial. And the Cantor story is interesting because he, as you say, he wasn't directly part of the operations, but kind of got involved because he was a relation. So fascinating to see where he was connected. I want to jump forward a little bit because, you know, a lot of people would know the political party, the Democratic Alliance, but I don't know if everybody knows where it sort of comes from. You had the Democratic Party for a long time, the DP, but before that, your grandfather was involved in sort of realigning the opposition so that it could be basically become what we would now call the DA.
Yeah, that's correct. He was sort of right at the center of sort of the realignment of opposition politics. So he first became sort of involved in opposition politics in 1951 when he was elected as a Johannesburg city councillor for the United Party. He then became a member of the Transvaal Provincial Council in 1958, where he became leader of the opposition a few years later, and then he became leader of the United Party in the Transvaal in 1973. But sort of at that time, there was a huge internal battle going on inside the United Party between sort of the distracted by de Villiers Graaf, who was the party leader, who sort of tacitly supported most of the apartheid legislation and weren't really providing the kind of robust opposition to apartheid that my grandfather and other sort of liberals in the party wanted. So there was this huge conflict going on between my grandfather's wing, which was sort of the liberal wing, referred to as the Young Turks, and the party's old guard. So my grandfather, various events happened, and essentially my grandfather was expelled from the United Party in February 1975, and along with a few other MPs and many other provincial councillors and local councillors. He was mainly expelled because he signed this key declaration with Chief Buthelezi in January 1974, and so he knew Chief Buthelezi well. He was sort of the main acknowledged black leader at the time. And they signed an accord called the Mashlevatini Declaration. And what the declaration signed up to, or prescribed for South Africa, was that apartheid should be ended. The sort of post-apartheid South Africa should provide a stake in society for everyone in South Africa, not just white South Africans. But that crucially also, apartheid should be ended through peaceful dialogue and negotiations. And even though those principles were ultimately signed up to by de Klerk and Mandela and others in the 1990s, actually in the 70s, that was quite a novel and sort of pioneering idea. So that really upset the old guard in the United Party, and that led to him and others being. So they formed this new party called the Reform Party, which my grandfather was leader of. And then 6 months later, in July 1975, they merged with the Progressive Party, which I'm sure you'll know well, was the party of Helen Suzman and Colin Eglin and others. And that merger really proved to realign opposition politics in South Africa. The party eventually became the Progressive Federal Party and became the official opposition in the 1977 election, which was a huge deal. The fact that the United Party, the party of Smuts and others, had now basically been eradicated, mostly from Parliament, and this new Liberal Party was now the official opposition, which of course allowed my grandfather and Helen Suzman and others to be in much sort of stronger position within Parliament to be able to advocate sort of anti-apartheid policies, but also expose the National Party on key areas to do with financial policy and sort of general management of the country.
Now, away from politics for a moment, he was also an important part of the Jewish community and worked on behalf of the Jewish community. What kind of involvement did he have there?
So he joined the Board of Deputies in the 1970s and eventually became the chairman, I believe in the 1980s, of their International Affairs Committee. That was quite an important sort of portfolio at the time, just because obviously South Africa faced a lot of isolation internationally. And so he sort of played quite an important part in making sure that actually Jews in South Africa weren't isolated, and sort of links were maintained for, you know, to Israel and other Jewish communities. It was sometimes sort of a source of tension actually within the Jewish community, his own anti-apartheid record. I think a lot of people, you know, viewed him unfortunately as a bit of a nuisance, because they thought actually, you know, the National Party aren't officially sort of opposed to Jews. They didn't have any legislation that discriminated against Jews in the same way as they did with other racial groups. So they thought actually, you know, we should generally kind of keep our noses down, and, you know, partly due to fear, I'm sure, actually Jews shouldn't be involved in the anti-apartheid movement. But my grandfather, you know, basically argued on the Board of Deputies for a long time that the board should be taking more of an active stance in condemning apartheid. And for a long time, the board's policy was to basically be the apolitical, and it wouldn't really get involved in these kinds of issues. But eventually, I believe it was 1984 or 1985, the board finally condemned apartheid, which is something which he certainly was a part of, sort of advocating that.
Yeah, so we're coming up just to almost to the end of the interview time allotted to us, but very quickly, he was also famous as having been the ambassador to the United States, one of the few Jews to get such a high up level in government in South Africa up to that point. What kind of stuff did he do there?
So the main reason why de Klerk appointed him was because obviously there was a lot of suspicion internationally about whether the National Party were actually going to end apartheid and sort of move towards all race elections. So they decided to appoint him to be ambassador of the United States, mainly basically to convince the United States and the world that they were actually going to end apartheid. I think they thought actually if you had someone who had a record of, you know, 30, 40 years behind him for opposing apartheid, saying that apartheid is going to end, that would add a lot of legitimacy to the government. So he was mainly involved in that, but crucially he was involved in trying to remove all the economic sanctions that were really crippling the South African economy by the 1990s. One of the issues that he had with that was that, obviously you may know, America's sort of federal system means that every one of the 50 states has its own system of laws and sanctions. So he had to go to basically all 50 states to make sure that those sanctions were removed at state level. We also engaged a lot at the sort of national level to remove those as well. And then, of course, as you move towards 1994, you prepared sort of elections to be held for South Africans to vote in America. And then after the election, he hosted President Mandela in October 1994, and had a important trip when Mandela was arriving, and increased investment and support for the country after the new elections. So those are the main things he'd really been working on.
And I'm sure that there's a lot of other stories that you could tell about us. We have about 2 minutes left. Do you have one in particular that perhaps speaks to you, something personal, something that he told you, you know, something that people would find interesting?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the main memory that sticks out was about sort of 10 years ago, I'd been attacked in the street sort of randomly. And, you know, as a sort of supportive grandfather, he called me up and asked if I was okay. But then he said to me, you know, something that was quite unexpected, I didn't quite understand at the time. He said to me, get everything out of this that you possibly can. And actually only came to me later that actually this was very much the way that he lived his life. You know, what could have been a sort of a sad story of a kind of penniless refugee, as it is for many, he kind of turned into one of success, and he kind of turned his disadvantages he had maybe from early on into advantages. The other thing that I would add is the very important role that my grandmother Annette had on my grandfather's political life. She ran all of his election campaigns, which were all successful. She was a trade unionist by background, so she had a very good eye for elections and understanding politics. And she was obviously a very brave anti-apartheid campaigner in her own right. And she really sort of laid a lot of the foundations for him in that respect. So that's something I would definitely say was very important as well.
Absolutely fascinating. Adam, unfortunately, all the time we've got for today, but I think if people want to read more about Harry Schwartz's life, you can check it out there. There was the article in the Jewish Report and on SA History, and Wikipedia actually has also a very comprehensive page. So if people want to find out more information about a hero, really, in the Jewish community, they can do it there. So thank you so much for your time and joining us on the New Blue Review.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really appreciate the invite.
Adam Schwartz there in a very, very cold London, joining us to talk about the life of Harry Schwartz.
From Johannesburg to Israel, from sport to business, this is 101.9 High FM.
So that's right, if you want to get in on the trolley dash, make sure that you do sign your slip at Pick and Pay. Trolley dash is always a lot of fun. My question is, are you allowed to place yourself right by the meat aisle and sort of pick up all the meat that you need for the Pesach period? We will have to see all about that. And it's very, very interesting what they are doing there. And we will obviously be following what's going on with Pesach in this show. Actually, we have a little bit going on. And by the way, if you are keen on Pesach this year, but you're not going to make the trolley dash, it is also worth considering other options. So if you're not sure where you're going to be spending Pesach this year, then perhaps you should have thought of going away for Pesach and going to the Taba Eco Lodge. It's just 20 minutes from Johannesburg, and you can come for a day and stay the night, or come for the whole of Pesach. It's all up to you. There are great daily activities, international rabbinic speakers, nightly entertainment, and the food is of the highest Chabad supervision. And of course, the accommodation is out of the world, this world. So for more details, visit the website oraffrica.godaddysites.com. That's oraffrica.godaddysites.com, or SMS Pesach to 34519, and they will contact you. That's Pesach to 34519. Something alternative that you can do on your Pesach this year. And I hope you did enjoy that discussion with Adam Schwartz. Very, very interesting to get into a bit of the history of the Jewish community, maybe find out things about people we didn't know about. And I'd love to know, who are your Jewish heroes in the community? Is there someone who does something heroic, either in the past or in current day, that you think really does an amazing job? Would love to hear from you. I'm all about figuring out who are the people in our community who are doing great things. So you can SMS us 34519. You can WhatsApp us 0618951019, 0618951019. Send us a tweet at High FM, or an email on air at highfm.com, and we'll very happily take your nominations for people in the community who are heroes, who are doing good things. I'd love to hear from you and get your perspective. Now, moving on a little bit into other things, I don't know if you've been watching some of the press. Certainly, if you've been listening to some of the other shows on the station, you may have picked up the story, but it is something which I think is going to become bigger, certainly as we run up into the next sort of week or so, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about it, so we might as well cover it now. And that has to do with the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, if you don't know what Eurovision is, that's okay, because basically it's not something that we really deal with that much in South Africa, but basically it was started just after World War II as a way of trying to unite the continent after, obviously, the big war there. And Eurovision is all of the different organizations that are affiliated to the Euro TV, basically broadcasting networks. Any place where you can get Europe TV, you can be part of the Eurovision Song Contest, which is why, despite the fact it's been called Eurovision, you get countries like Australia participating, and as you'll see in a minute, Israel
as well. And it's very, very interesting because what happens is each country in the Eurovision network submits a song that then gets voted on as being the top song of that Eurovision awards. And it's quite a complicated system. You've got to have a jury which votes on the song, and they have a popular vote, and then that's all added up and getting points, and then those points are added up. And it goes to a whole pool of points, rather, and that then gets put together, and you get the winning song. So this brings in a lot of interesting aspects to it, because the country in the country itself, you're not allowed to vote for your own song. So if it's Russia, for example, you can't vote for the Russian entry that year, which means that you're relying on other countries in this Euro bloc to vote for your country. And this leads to some interesting politics, because obviously some countries are less interested in voting for other countries just on the basis of their politics, not on the basis of the art. So you'll, for example, find the Greeks never vote for the Turks, and the Ukrainians don't vote for the Russian songs at the moment, and all of the cultural blocs tend to vote together. So anything that is Swedish or from Iceland or Finnish, they often get the support of those people. The UK and Ireland tend to get some sorts of backing. And the politics is at least as interesting as the song itself. And you often find that the popular vote is different from the jury vote. And if you know ABBA, you will know that this is where they got their start at Eurovision. So why am I even talking about this at all? Well, it's about a week and a bit to go for this Eurovision 2018, and the odds on favorite to win this year is actually an Israeli song. Now, the Israelis have won Eurovision before, once in the 80s and once in 1998, and crucially, very famous, I think it was 98, where the singer was Dana, and she was a trans woman. So it was a sort of a boundary-breaking event, both in Israel and in the Eurovision. But this year is a completely different kettle of fish entirely, and it seems to be leading the pack and getting a lot of interest, not just in Eurovision countries, even a lot of Arab countries seem to be picking up on the song. The song is called Toy, and it's done by a woman. Her name is Netta Brizeli, and it's interesting because it mixes English and sort of Hebrew songs as well as some Arabic style. Now remember, the thing about Eurovision is it's at least one part visual as much as it is a song. So we are going to play it for you in a bit, but you need to actually go and have a look at Toy on the website, on YouTube or on Eurovision, if you are interested, because you miss half of the interesting aspects about it. And it seems to have both captured the sort of feminist moment that we're going through, the Me Too movement. It's got a very sort of feminist sound to it, and it also has a bit of a crazy style to it. But and a lot of people hate it, and a lot of people love it. It's definitely a highly divisive song, but whatever its merits, it is currently being looked at as the number one favorite. Now, whether it will win or not, it's already hit about 7 million views on YouTube, so it's already getting an enormous amount of prominence, and it will be interesting to see where the song itself goes. So let's take a short break, and then when we come back, we're going to be listening to Toy. I'd love to know what you think.
Stay relevant and up to date. Informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
101.9 High FM. What did you think of that, Netta Brizeli and Toy? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you love it? Do you hate it? And do you think it's going to win? 34519, that's our SMS line. You can also WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019. Tweet us at High FM or email us on air at High FM. And while you're doing that, you should also take note that the Pick and Pay Hyper Nord Kosher Butchery wants to make Pesach more affordable for you. So listen to this. Every time you spend 500 rands at the butchery, put your slip into the box at the information counter, and on Tuesday the 27th of March, it could be your name drawn for 1,000 rands worth of meat products from the Kosher Butchery. Pick and Pay Hyper Nord wishes you and your family a Chag Sam Chag Kasha V'Sameach. Oh, there you go. You can get both of your matzah and your meat at Pick and Pay. Sounds great. So, yep, I'd love to hear your views. What do you think of Toy and Netta? I think it's a fascinating song. And one which might very well win the Eurovision Song Contest. So, could be fascinating and could be interesting. Now, I want to move along to something new on the Jewish thinking scene at the moment. A lot of people in Joburg wouldn't be aware of them because it is a Cape Town-based institution, but there's a lot of interesting stuff coming out of the Kaplan Center at the moment, Kaplan Center for Jewish Studies, based at UCT. And they have a relatively new chairman, CEO, director, I don't know, whatever you call it, of the center, Adam Mendelson, who's been doing some tremendous work to really get the academics out of their ivory towers and having a discussion in the general populace, which I think is a really good move. And they've been doing some excellent stuff, which I think is impacting positively on the Jewish community. Last year, for example, they did a anti-Semitism survey, or not really anti-Semitism, but understanding views of Jews by the broader population of South Africa, which gave everyone a proper indication of, you know, where are Jews being seen at in the South African context. They've been looking at researching books and doing seminars, and I think it's also engaging with the Jewish students. So I think that that's all a very, very positive and needed aspect of what they do, because it's not like America or the UK where we've got a dozen different policy think tanks. We only really have one in this country, which is them. And if they don't engage with the community, then that is, I think, a loss. Now, as part of this outreach engagement program, if you like, they've also launched a new website called Dafka.com. It's calling itself Many Issues and More Voices. And it seems to be a sort of academic type engagement, trying to get different voices, or more voices rather, into the space. And they've done a couple of different ones, including one about Jews and community rights in South Africa, and another one talking about the community in general, and you should go read them. There's only been three published so far, but it's certainly very interesting. It's the third one that really caught my eye, and it's by Professor Stephen Friedman, and it's talking about the ANC and the future of South Africa-Israel relations. Now, I thought it was a bit of a strange choice to pick Professor Stephen Friedman, because he is a professor who is very supportive of the BDS, and doesn't really want to allow Israeli academics to engage with South African institutions. And UCT is currently embroiled in a debate about whether it should boycott Israeli institutions and universities or not. So it seemed to be a bit of a strange choice. And I also think it talks to the paucity of people who we actually have in the community, or even outside the community, who can talk to issues of international relations when it comes to Israel, because Professor Friedman does get a lot of airtime on this topic, and he does have obviously a very specific viewpoint. So I do think that as a community, we may have to start investing in new, younger people who can take on policy approaches from a variety of different angles, not just sort of the standard BDS line being dressed up as academia. Now, besides the person of Mr. Friedman being chosen, I also clearly disagree with his view, which basically comes down to this. He's saying that he doesn't believe that the recent uptick in BDS activity in South Africa is in fact a threat, A, to the Jewish community, and B, to the South African-Israel relationship itself. And basically, he bases it on two assumptions. The first is that he doesn't believe that the BDS movement is itself anti-Semitic. And second of all, his argument is that it just hasn't been all that successful at all in driving the relationship between the two downwards. And that's the sort of basic underlying part of his thinking. Now, I would say that this is sort of wrong on two accounts. First of all, there's a large and growing body of academic research that very clearly posits BDS as being an anti-Semitic movement from a variety of perspectives, including the idea of double standards, where it only singles out Israel, the way that it describes Israel as a unique evil, the denial of Jewish rights to sovereignty in Israel whilst pushing it for the Palestinians, the removal of diplomatic and military institutions that protect Jews. So I don't really want to get into it, but certainly from a Jewish community perspective, I don't think that there's any doubt that BDS is an anti-Semitic movement. And just because it dresses itself up as a human rights organization, I don't think we need to necessarily take that seriously, because anti-Semites throughout the ages have always dressed up their anti-Semitism with the discourse of the day, whether it's people who killed Jesus, or as part of racial biology, whatever it was. Anti-Semites have tended to fit their narrative into whatever was popular at the time. So where Dr. Friedman or Professor Friedman sees people who are simply aberrations that commit anti-Semitic offenses from the BDS movement, I think that the community tends to see it as a recurrent and obvious pattern that comes out of a movement that has an anti-Semitic agenda. Now, Professor Friedman is correct when he says that this is has not been an effective movement, right? He is correct that it hasn't really had a serious victory. And his point is that he believes that their assault on the ANC is incorrect. Now, we may or may not know whether that is the truth. The ANC has been focusing on a lot of its policy frameworks, including the land question, nationalizing the Reserve Bank. So there's no reason why to think that they won't come after the Israel question. The problem, of course, for the BDS is that it doesn't actually affect Israel, and it can't. Even if South Africa did break ties, it would be basically symbolic. And so what tends to happen is, because the BDS cannot affect Israel actually in any way, and if South Africa doesn't engage as a country, it can't actually affect Israel in any way, they tend to take it out on the targets that are most closest to Israel, which tends to be the Jewish community. And that really what leads to the serious anti-Semitism. So that, in brief, is why I disagree with Professor Friedman's article in Dafka.com. But I would encourage you to read it yourself and let us know what you think. I'd be very happy to hear.
A frequency like no other. 101.9 Chai FM.
Now, it is obviously Pesach coming up on Friday, so we are going to, you know, not have another show before then. So I did want to leave on a Pesach message and something, you know, that people could take away with them. And, of course, there's always different rabbis who have different perspectives, but I thought I would bring you something slightly different today. If you are a big YouTuber, you will know of a man called Jordan Peterson. He is a psychologist from Canada. He's actually a Christian. And he's become very, very famous for fighting the so-called culture wars, fighting against people being thrown off university campuses, become a big free speech warrior. And he is a very considered and interesting guy to listen to on philosophy. And he also has a big interest in the Old Testament, and particularly the characters and stories. And he has a great video, you should go and check it out on YouTube, where he talks about the Exodus and freedom, which of course is a great theme coming up to Pesach. And what he argues essentially is that the part of freedom that is the Exodus is actually not the freedom part. Basically, you know, God intervenes in the world and allows the Jews to escape. But when they get to the desert, that's really when the journey begins. And that's when they have to sort of start walking around and bashing into things, so to speak, to try and figure out their way, and that they get a lot wrong. But over the period of the time, they sort of straighten themselves out and eventually go on to become the people who settle the land in Israel, etc. And it's not a completely unique idea. You can find it amongst a lot of rabbis, but it's very interesting to hear what it basically is, a secular secular psychology philosophy speaker, someone who deals basically in contemporary issues talking about freedom, using the Exodus as a key text. So if you are interested in it, you can have a look on his website, jordanpeterson.com, Psychological Significance of Biblical Stories, and check it out on YouTube as well. It's not a long thing, maybe 5 to 10 minutes, but if you want something different for your Pesach preparation this year, I can recommend Jordan Peterson, and he has a whole series. There's like 15-part series on all sorts of biblical stories. So if that's of interest to you and you follow Jordan Peterson, I just thought I would bring that to your attention, and also bring to your attention that it is the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Mandy for doing the production, and to Craig for pushing all the big red buttons, and for Vusi for helping us out with the sound today. I will see you next week. It's a public holiday, so it should be exciting, but we'll chat to you then.